Aroba ni baba itan. Aroba is the father of history.
In Yoruba wisdom, this saying reminds us that storytelling is the heartbeat of memory, of culture, and of who we are becoming. In today's episode, we're in conversation with a storyteller of a different cloth, one who sees with a lens that reaches far beyond images. Damilola Onofoa is a visual artist from Lagos, Nigeria, working across digital photography, film, and mixed media to hold space for human stories that might otherwise go unheard. His work, grounded in personal experience, curiosity, and compassion, turns the camera towards people and cultures, not as a spectacle, but as a sacred mirror. Damilola's vision doesn't end behind the camera. In 2024, he launched Aroba Creative Hub, a cultural space in Lagos designed to mentor emerging creatives, preserve heritage, and build sustainable creative practices. Aroba isn't just a name, it's a declaration, a return to the archive of African knowledge, a commitment to reimagining futures rooted in identity and economy. Whether through Story Maxima, his storytelling organization, or through his community building work at Aroba, Damilola continues to ask, what does it mean to tell stories that matter? And how do we make that work sustainable for those who tell them? This conversation is about art, heritage, and the economics of cultural preservation. So settle in and journey with us as we meet the heart and mind behind the lens. Welcome, Damilola, to the HM podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Shu.
Great. So I'll just ask you to kind of share a bit about your background. Let people know you.
My name is Damilola Onofoa. I'm a documentary photographer and filmmaker. I'm currently based in Lagos, Nigeria, but I am a citizen of the world. I started, you know, photography and filmmaking not at the same time. I started as a photographer. Actually started as a graphic designer and, you know, grew to become a photographer and then eventually added filmmaking. And I've been doing this for over 10 years. So yeah, wow. That's basic background about me.
Great. So let me find out how did you first discover your passion in all of this?
My passion for storytelling and visual arts didn't start when I grew up. Okay. It started since I was a child. As a child, I was drawn to colors. I love colors so much. Mm. And there's this very funny story that my dad likes to tell me a lot. It is when I was a kid and they asked what's my name, I would tell them my name was Color Dami.
Oh, wow.
That's how much I loved colors. And I felt like, oh, there's yellow, there's blue, there's white. Why is there no Color Dami? Duh.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. So I introduced myself as that. And storytelling runs deep within my family. I grew up with, I had a grandma that loved to tell stories. You know, we would sit down on the mat under the stars and we would just hear stories all night long. When we had holidays and we went to one of my, you know, uncle's houses, his kids would sit us down and then we would just all share stories. So storytelling runs deep within my family. I grew up hearing stories, learning stories, and I love colors. I love art. So a combination of that was, you know, all that came together to, you know, put me on this path.
Oh, great to know that. So reading about you online and all of that, you have described yourself as a cultural activist as well. So yeah. I want you to kind of share a bit of that journey as well.
I believe that, you know, culture is very important because it is the way of life of people. It is how we know who we are. It is how we are formed. It is how our relationship with the world that we live in is developed, right? And I find that if you look back and you look at now, you find that a lot of people are losing their culture. People are losing the culture of reading. People are losing the culture of festivities, of stories, right? And one of the things that I do is to stand in the gap and ensure that people don't lose that. So yeah, that makes me a cultural activist, as well as a visual storyteller, because I am a visual storyteller. I'm a photographer, I'm a filmmaker. And if you look at some of the stories, or if you look in the stories that I tell, there are stories of preservation, there are stories of joy, of the sadness, of the struggles of everyday people, things that remind us of our humanity. So yeah, that's it for me. And also, like, my background, my upbringing, my background basically played a very big part in this trajectory.
Okay, you had mentioned your dad and your grandmother. Who else have been part of influencing your journey, apart from those two people you've mentioned?
My entire family have been a part of my, my influence as an artist. My mom inclusive, my siblings included. And because I grew up in a very big family, and when I was growing up, I was the last of 8 children.
Wow.
Right? Exactly. And I grew up in what you consider a communal household.
So
everybody did everything together. Everybody was present. Everybody was doing their best. I saw, and as the last child, one of the blessings, one of the advantages of that is that you get to see life from everybody's perspective. You just sit back and watch everybody do everything, and then you learn, right? As you grow up, you choose what is good for you and what isn't good for you just by watching, right?
Yeah, and yeah.
So I can say that all of my siblings played incredible part in the person that I am today. My parents, I have very incredible parents, amazing parents, cultural parents. In fact, one event particularly that I remember, it's not an event, like a ritual, something that happens particularly when I was growing up that I don't think I'll ever forget is, you know, when we went to school, right? And then we learned English, we learned science, we learned all the topics. But in school, we're not allowed to speak our local languages. We're not allowed to speak it, but they called it vernacular. Whenever I got back home, right, English became vernacular in my home.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. Do you understand? So I believe that I had a very well-rounded background in that sense, because my mother tongue was called vernacular in school, in the educational system. But back in my house, we were made to understand that our language was very important, and it was as important as the language we were learning, right? Even more important because it was our roots, right? So you can say that I had the best of both worlds.
Interesting. Most people grew up with English being the first language. I remember speaking to a friend, and she was telling me about how she's pained because she can't speak her local language, because at home they were forced to speak English for some reason. Yeah, and now we've met, and I can speak the language, but she can't speak, and it annoys her that we can't gist in public. You know how sometimes you want to say something, you don't want everybody to know what you're talking about.
Right.
Even though that is becoming difficult.
Mm. Oh yeah, even till date, I never speak English with my siblings or my parents.
Oh wow, okay.
Never. Oh wow. Like, if you ever see me and my siblings together, or me and my parents together, it's all Yoruba. There's no English. Maybe we can mix it somewhere in between. Or if we had somebody in the room who didn't speak the language and we wanted to carry along with the language, that's only when you see us speaking English.
English. All right. Great. So, Damian, I want to talk to you about your projects, right? You're known for projects like Angels Among Men and Beautiful Noise. There are so many, actually. But what I want to know is, how do you decide which human stories to shine your light on? I mean, what inspires those projects?
My every story that I decide to tell is inspired by certain either incidences in my life or personal experiences. And Angels Among Men was a story that I did. It was the very first public story that I did that actually went very international. And it was a story that explored the lives of Nigerians living with albinism, right? And my goal for that story was to debunk myths associated with albinism, right? And to allow people see people living with albinism as one of us, which is quite ironic with the title that I gave to it, by the way. I named it Angels Among Men, whereas I wanted them to be seen as like us, like everybody else.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's some sort of play on words there. Why did I decide that that was a story worth telling? Like I said, my stories are influenced by my life experiences. I remember when I was in primary school, as we call it, there was a young kid who had albinism in our school, and everybody would just pick on this kid and bully this kid. And they would say derogatory terms like Afiokinje or which is that? People living with albinism do not eat salt, or you have like several beliefs, like outdated beliefs on the subject, like the mother had an affair with a white person, that's why this child is neither white nor black. Like very outrageous beliefs. In some other parts of Africa, actually, it goes even deeper, that you have people believing them to have supernatural powers, and if you kill them, you can use them for wealth. So I, as a child, participated in all of those myths and stuff. I sang the songs, the jest songs, you know, but I didn't know better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I grew up and had an encounter with one person living with albinism, and then she was to get married to somebody else. And then it just dawned on me like, oh, this person is no different than any other person, right?
Like, absolutely.
Why did we do all the things? So exactly. So it started as a question of why did I participate in all this stuff? Where did it come from? What was the origin? So it was an inquiry into the project, Angels Among Men. So I decided I was going to do a photo series that further shed light on where these, you know, misconceptions came from, how we have reinforced them, and why we need to, you know, stop it and kill it and just deal with people living with albinism as everybody. So I did a photo series called Angels Among Men, where I presented them I made them wear white, and I presented them like in like clean portraits, made them look like themselves. I went to events where you had a lot of people living with albinism, where I documented their day-to-day interactions. I documented like so many aspects of their lives, and then I put that together in a body of work. And that body of work like went like whoo, a lot. Yeah.
Great. And what role do you believe storytelling plays in driving cultural change or social awareness, really?
I believe the storytelling is one of the best ways, right, that you can drive cultural awareness. Because as human beings, the only thing that we understand, the way that we understand, you know, the worlds that we live in is through stories.
Yeah.
Whether we like it or not. Stories are the basis for history, right? Every single thing that you know today, that we've learned today, we've learned through stories. That's why as kids, we were taught how to read stories. We had books where you say, I go up, up we go, it goes down. The English people will tell you about Rumpelstiltskin, right? Uh-huh. They will tell you about Humpty Dumpty, who sat on the wall. Like, stories paint us a vivid picture of our world, right? And it's how we understand it. There will be no understanding of the world without stories. So I believe that if we are to change narratives, if we're to help each other understand ourselves, if we're to, we have to tell ourselves stories all the time, consistently. So in saying that, I believe storytelling does not play a small role. It plays a very key role in helping us understand ourselves, understand the world we live in, and to influence, you know, a perception and to shift culture and to make things happen. Nothing happens in this life without a story being told. Nothing.
So in 2023, you launched Aroba Creative Hub to nurture young creatives and preserve cultural heritage.
Absolutely.
First of all, I'm going to ask, what does Aroba mean? And how does this idea, you know, shape the mission and the activity of the hub?
Of the hub. Right.
Yeah.
So we started actually developing Aroba Create. We started developing the idea of Aroba Creative Hub in 2024, actually. And the goal was, okay, so I'll start from what Aroba means. Aroba is taken from a Yoruba adage, right? That says, "Ti omode oba ba itan." Umaba Aroba, Aroba ni baba ito. And it literally means that if a child, for whatever reason, right, does not meet history or meets or meets documented life, right? What they will meet is wisdom in the mouth of elders, which loosely translates into stories, the kind of stories my grandmother told me when I was growing up. Right. That's what you loosely translate to Aroba, right? And the adage now goes on to say that that is the foundation of histories, which means that stories are the foundation of histories, loosely, right? Which is the core of what I've been talking about, like, since the beginning of this podcast.
You see
how that influenced the name of the hub that we've created as well, is like, we must preserve culture, we must preserve history, and by doing so, we must have stories.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So that's what Aroba means. And then we started the Creative Hub so that we can, you know, have a hub where we can preserve knowledge, we can nurture young creative minds. Out of Lagos, out of Nigeria, out of Africa, and then we can help them to learn that stories are important, culture is important, and they must be preserved by all means.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So I visited Aroba early this year.
Yes, you did.
Yes. And one of the things that we spoke about during that conversation, and it led me to say, Damilola, I would like to have you on my podcast, was about the business and entrepreneurial skills that the hub is planning to give to people, participants. And that's why I want to talk to you about. How do you see Aruba's role in making cultural work sustainable?
The key word in your question is sustainability here.
Mm-hmm.
there is no sustainability in any work without money, whether we like it or not, right? It does not exist. And so how do we ensure that our work is sustainable? I believe in, because I've been a cultural and creative entrepreneur for many, many years, over 10 years now. I believe in doing business. I believe in, you know, creating value, right? Mm-hmm. And in creating value, money comes, right?
Absolutely.
And I believe that we have to, as Africans, as Nigerians, at some point start shifting from the point where we are dependent on, what do you call it, handouts, right? Because it is not sustainable. What if the person who gives you handouts decide all of a sudden that I don't want to give you anymore? What happens to us? Case in point, USAID. In the US, USAID was giving a lot of money to a lot of causes. Many good causes, by the way, in Nigeria, across Africa. And all of a sudden, they had a new president and decided no more, right? Many, many, many places shut down. Many projects shut down as a result of that, right? So I believe that as Africans, we must think about profitability as well as in order to encourage sustainability. We must think about profitability and impact hand in hand. We cannot separate it, right?
Absolutely.
So one of the core values, or one of the things that we're trying to do with Aruba, is we want to stay profitable. We want to create a profitable system where we offer storytelling services that bring profit to us. But at the same time, we prioritize impact. So we make profit for impact, right? If you think about many billionaires who are philanthropists today, they made their money by doing business.
Absolutely.
Right? And by doing business, when they did business and made money, they decided, okay, you know what? This money, I'm going to put it back into impact. I believe that that's the point where we need to reach as Nigerians, as Africans. It's like we have to create a value system that allows us to make money, right? And then take that money and diversify and move it into impact and help our communities. And that's one of the things that I am doing through the Aruba Creative Hub. Is we do business. I run a business called Story Maxima. We do business and we use that business. Whatever comes from that, we throw it back into, you know, impacting our communities, impacting young people, teaching them about their cultures, teaching them about their histories, teaching them how to tell their stories in ways that matter.
Damilola, please, can you describe some of the specific programs or workshop at the Hub that embodies this philosophy?
One of the first things that we did when we started Aruba was to start monthly programming that kept people coming to the Hub, that kept people, you know, understanding what Aruba was about. And we called it Aruba Presents, right? And this has included film screenings by up-and-coming young storytellers out of Nigeria. You know, and we get them to come to the Hub to talk about what their work is about, what's has inspired their work, and why they think it is important to, you know, do the kind of work that they've done. After that, we've run, you know, art projects. We called it the Joy of Art, and it was to bring a seasoned artist into the place to teach beginner artists how they started their practice and how they are where they are, and to teach them how to draw as well and how to paint. Those are just a few ones. Earlier last year, we did a project we called the Documentary Bootcamp. And the Documentary Bootcamp, what it did was, it was a program that brought about 10 early to mid-career filmmakers in documentary into a particular space for a duration of 3 days, right? Where they learned skills, soft skills, like how do you even relate with clients? How do you make your practice sustainable? How do you tell stories? What are the angles to tell stories? What is your power as somebody who is behind the lens, right? Mm. How do you, you know, influence and shape culture with the kind of stories that you tell, right? Right. So those are just a few projects that we've coming up very soon. And the focus is on female storytellers. How do we make room for female storytellers? How do we allow them to be able to express, you know, what's happening in the environment from their perspective, from a female-centric perspective? And we've targeted, we've called this project Photographer and Filmmaker, with the her at the end, H-E-R in capital letter.
Okay.
Right. And then there's also another project that we are working on. We haven't started that yet. It's a creative incubator project, right? And it's an accelerator program for young and upcoming storytellers and creative practitioners to come to understand how do they build profitable businesses, right? Using storytelling, right? So these are all some of the projects that we worked on in the past and some that we have lined up.
Great. I look forward to joining that one of them, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Okay, just on the issue of the economic viability, I would like you to kind of, what would you advise other people coming in, younger artists coming in, trying to make a living from all of this that we're talking about? What would be your advice to them?
Well, if I would give any advice to upcoming, you know, visual artists and cultural practitioners, the advice that I would give is, while it is important to do impactful work, it is also important to do profitable work. And creating a fine line between these can really be like your nexus, basically, is impactful work. Of course, it is what it is. It gives impact. It helps, you know, societies where you work. It helps, you know, pass down knowledge to other people. It helps make the world a better place, right? While profitable work helps you maintain your work. I have seen many artists become very dependent on, oh, what's the next funding? Where is it coming from? While I encourage that, I also would further encourage that you do not make the entirety of your life about it. Right? Because it's, I mean, we're talking about how sustainable can your practice be? If you know, consider doing this for a very long time, becoming a creative for a very long time, then I would suggest you create a kind of structure that allows you earn, even if your money will eventually go to impact, right? And create like a very fine balance between these two. I'm a big advocate of that.
Yeah. So, but my question would be then to you is, I mean, how do you balance these, the profitability with impactful work?
That's where the real struggle is.
So what challenges have you faced in trying to do that?
You know, one of the challenges you face, like either ways you face challenges, right? Mm-hmm. If you decide to do basically impactful work and you're just doing impact, 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 impact needs funding.
Yes.
Right? And in the world we live where funding pockets are very small, and the people who need funding are way more than the funding available.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand? There is struggle. Would you now say if you do not get funding, you are not going to do impact?
No.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's, and we find a lot of people do that. They wait until they're able to get funding before they go ahead and do impact. Right? And that is to a very large extent, not very sustainable.
Mm.
If you ask me, right? We have people who've gotten like unrestricted funding for like 4 years, 5 years. And the moment the money stops or the funnel stops, it's like they don't know what to do. All the impact they've done, they will no longer proceed.
Mm.
It's like, how do you even monitor the impact that you've done if your funding all of a sudden stops? Right? So, and there is the other part where you do business and you're strictly focused on making business, making business, making business. And then you forget to do impactful work because you're so busy doing business and you can get carried away making money and you forget to actually do work that lifts your spirit and lifts the spirit of all the people around you. So the real work here is how do you stay somewhere in the middle and then you balance both ends?
Okay.
I am not going to say it will be easy because it is not easy. Right? Because I have fallen into one spectrum or the other before. It's like all you're doing is doing impactful work and then you are unable to do impactful work because you're running out of money. And then on the other spectrum, you are just doing profitable work and you're unable to do impactful work. So one of the ways I have maintained this balance, for instance, is by creating a structure like the creative hub that we have. Right? And it's, we do, my business, which runs for profit, still continues to run for profit, right?
Yeah.
And there, we have people who work in that business, right? And, you know, ensure that we get the right customers, ensure that our papers are up to date, ensure that we get business, basically, and we make money, right? And then we take part of that money and then we put it into the hub, right? A percentage of that money, and we put a very significant percentage of the profit from that business, and we put it into the hub, which helps us to fund the impact.
Fantastic structure.
Exactly. So it is not a perfect structure yet because we're still growing in this. We're still learning. We're still seeking help. How do we make our books more, you know, structured? How do we organize properly? How do we get the best staff to manage these two different ends of, you know, the structure in such, and I'm just here as the founder and director steering that ship, right? Every new knowledge, with every new relationship build, with every new, you know, information, just steering this ship accordingly. We are far from getting to a perfect outcome yet, but we have a vision, we have an idea, we have a goal, right? And we're constantly chasing this.
I wish you the very best in that.
Thank you very much. Very
inspiring. I am all for the profitability. I'm all for the need to start to seek for, work on projects that fund itself in some way or the other, rather than depending externally for our own cultural preservation. It's like handing the gun to somebody else
when
you want to. Yeah, so. So I would like us to go on to the issue of collaboration. I see that you've worked with a number of organizations and people in delivering your project so far. How important is collaboration, first of all, in your creative process? And How does collaboration shape your perspective on what kinds of story you tell? Actually, there are two different questions. So let me first ask one. How important is collaboration?
Well, collaboration, if done right, can be the lifeblood, right, of creative projects. But many times you cannot do creative projects on your own. You need to collaborate. If, for instance, you're telling stories of certain people, you need those people, you need to collaborate with those people to tell their stories, right? Because as much as I tell stories that reflect my lived experiences, my, you know, conversations with people, there are other people involved in the stories, and collaborating with them is the way to go. Secondly, I also believe that collaboration is one of the easiest ways, right, to get to offload unnecessary things off yourself. To take a lot of load off yourself. It's like you have strengths, right? Mm-hmm. And you have weaknesses. In places where you have weaknesses, other people have strengths, right? In collaboration, we can bridge that strength, right? We can bring a combination of my strength and your strength, and your weakness, your strength covering for my weakness, to achieve a common goal. So I believe that collaboration is very, very important. And we're constantly, either at my business or at Araba, we're constantly looking for collaborators. So I believe that collaboration is very, very important. In fact, there's a current project that we're doing at the Creative Hub, and it's called the DocuScreen Project Nigeria. It's a purely collaborative project. We are screening international documentary films across six locations in Nigeria, like six states, including Lagos, Abuja, Benin, Maiduguri, Kano, and Port Harcourt, six locations. And we have managed to collaborate with other creative hubs across the country to bring this project to fruition.
Wow.
Yeah, so collaboration is the lifeblood of creativity. Yeah.
Yeah, so let me ask, how do you then approach collaborating with artists or communities? And like, yeah, how did you, with this DocuScreen you just talked about, how did you approach it?
One of the things that I believe is very important when collaborating is shared vision and shared ideologies, right? So when we are collaborating, these are some of the first things that we're looking for. What do you envision? What do you envision, like, the person or the community or the artist that we're trying to create? Like, what's your vision? Does it align with ours? Do we have ideologies that are similar? Because we've also had collaborations gone bad, right? Because we didn't have shared vision or shared ideologies, right? You have a certain idea of how certain things should go, and you believe it's right, but this other person also has another, you know, ideology on how things should go, and they also believe it's right. Right? So that is room for, you know, anarchy. That's room for disagreement right there. So one of the first things we look for is shared vision and shared ideologies. When we find that we have shared vision and shared ideologies, I believe that we can always work out the details. All that is left is in the conversations that we will have. Like, this is what we're trying to achieve. This is what you're trying to achieve. Is there a common ground? How can we bridge that? And I also believe in shared, what do you call it? I'm looking for the word. Because many people use collaboration as a form of, I'm trying to say they use it to use people as a form of exploitation. Do you understand? Yeah. So it has to be mutually beneficial. Right? When we collaborate, my idea of collaboration is that It is mutually beneficial. What I am bringing to the table, what you are bringing to the table, it both, you know, deals with and helps us to reach our goals faster in one way or another.
Interesting.
You understand? It cannot be one-sided. So when we propose a collaboration, we are bringing values. We're telling you this is the value that we bring to you. This is what this is how we benefit you as an organization. And you have to believe it, because if you don't believe it, then we're just selling you stuff. Right?
Yeah.
You have to believe that that's what it does for you as well. And then, of course, it's both ways. It goes vice versa.
Yeah,
right? It has to be beneficial to both parties. And that's my approach. And that's the approach that, you know, my organization uses when approaching artists or communities in collaboration.
Yeah, that's a very good approach. The mutual benefit, mutual respect, mutual trust. We've seen this play out a lot of times where, things are not as balanced, and then somebody isn't as happy as they thought the collaboration would be.
Or somebody's reaping all the benefits and just taking from the others.
Having said that, I see that you've worked with big organizations like UNICEF, the Skoll Foundation, the World Food Program, and all of that. How have these organizations shaped your perspectives on the kind of stories you tell, if at all they've been influential?
Thank you very much for that question. Thank you very much for that question. Well, true, I have worked with organizations like UNICEF, Skoll Foundation, World Food Program, among many others. And I consider myself very privileged to be able to do the kind of work that I do for those organizations. Because if you think about it, like in the past, what you have is other people telling our people's stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's what it puts in your face that you see. And I say that I feel privileged because now as a Nigerian, as an African, I get to become a part of a system that is, and you can clearly see the difference. When I tell stories for organizations like this, I tell it from a position of empowerment, of support for our people. So it's not from a position of like weakness. Because I know that our people are not weak. I know that our people are some of the most resilient people you will ever come across. And so I bring all this perspective to the stories that I tell for these organizations. How this, you know, working with those organizations has helped me shaped my perspective on the kind of stories that I tell is the fact that, first of all, working with organizations like this bring to your attention many things that you probably would not, you know, be aware of that happens in your community. Because whether we like it or not, these organizations do like incredibly important work in the places that they work.
So Damilola, can you give an example of one of those things? So one of your projects where you were also surprised at what was happening within that community that you didn't know about before your project.
Okay. One of those would be, you know, when you get a brief or you get an assignment and say, oh, this thing is happening here. Or when you sit down in your living room anywhere in the world, or in Lagos, in Abuja, in London, wherever it is, and you hear news, right, about, oh, there's conflict happening here, or some people have been dealt with this certain way, all you experience is that, oh, these people are just barbarians killing themselves, right? It is very different when you go to the field and you are on ground. And you are able to understand the resilience of people. I have been in situations where, you know, some people have to run for safety, right? From one village to another for 2-3 years consistently.
Oh, wow.
Right? And in running, when you have conversations with them, their spirit is not dampened. They are constantly looking for ways to survive, ways to evolve, ways to become better people. I have seen people start businesses in camps. Right? In displacement camps, I've seen people start fresh business. I've seen farmers grow like vegetables that they ate in displacement camps. Nobody wants or prays to be displaced, right? When somebody gets displaced from their homes for one reason or another and finds a temporary home and decides to bring value to that structure, that's a beautiful thing. It's many things that you don't see in mainstream media. And those are some of the stories that I bring to the fore.
Incredible stories, actually. This when you see resilience in full form. Just to bring this to a close, yeah. What are your aspirations for the future, for this space, right? For the
culture. Do I have 1 hour? Do I have 1 hour to speak? Yeah. Well, my aspiration for myself, for, you know, my creative business and for the creative hub that I'm building is big, is huge. First of all, I look forward to an Africa, right, where every creative person is, you know, given the opportunities, right, that they need to succeed and compete globally. It's one of the things that we do not have in Africa, where every resource an African needs or an African creative needs to succeed, to compete globally is given to them, right? And right here on home soil, we don't have to look, you know, for external validation or external support to do that, right? That's one of my biggest aspirations. And I also look forward to before I digress, right? I believe that if that happens and when that happens, that is only when we can have a level ground to have conversations, global conversations. That's where we truly can. And for Aroba, I mean, we started Aroba in Lagos. I look forward to Aroba, you know, having offices in every major city across Africa. Like, you will have an Aroba in, we have an Aroba in Lagos. We would have a bigger Aroba office in Lagos. We would have in Abuja. We would have in Nairobi. We would have in Dakar. We would have an Aroba in, you know, Ouagadougou. We'll have an Aroba in, name it, in Marrakech, in Casablanca. Do you understand? That's my goal, that a creative community that allows people grow, that allows people, you know, lean into their own stories and their strengths exists in every major city in Africa, right? And for Story Maxima, one of my goals is that we will also, like, be doing stories across the entire continent. Right? And we'll have offices across the entire, we'll become a multinational company that does stories. And we will be known as like one of the best, if not the best, storytelling agency across Africa.
I'm sure somebody's thinking in their mind, oh, okay, Story Maxima is a storytelling organization. I've got a story. I don't know how to tell it. How do I work with Story Maxima to tell this story? What exactly would that person need to be able to do that?
We'll go ahead and look at some of our past work on our website at www.storymaxima.com. You can just write us an email at info@storymaxima.com.
Okay.
Definitely, definitely respond as soon as possible. We're very fast.
All right, no problem. Great. Thank you so much, Damilola. I share your aspirations for a level playing field for Africa when it comes to cultural preservation, cultural management. I look forward to that, and I wish you the very best with Aroba and Story Maxima. Thank you so much for sharing on the HN podcast.
And to our dear listeners, thank you for listening. Until next time, take care.